How Pritchett received the age of Kali. Text 1. Suduvacha.
Suduvacha.
Tata.
Tata.
Parikshit.
Parikshit.
Dvijavaya.
Dvijavaya.
Shikshaya.
Shikshaya.
Mahim.
Mahim.
Mahabhagavata.
Mahabhagavata.
Shashasa.
Shashasa.
Ha.
Yatha,
yatha,
ki,
ti,
sutyam,
sutyam,
abhijata kovida,
abhijata kovida,
samadishan,
samadishan,
vipra,
vipra,
mahatguna,
mahatguna,
tatha,
tatha,
sutuvacha,
sutuvacha,
tatha parikshit dvijavaya sikshaya,
tatha parikshit dvijavaya sikshaya,
mahi maha, Bhagavatashashasah
Mahi Mahabhagavatashashasah
Yathahi Sutyam Abhijata Kovida
Yathahi Sutyam Abhijata Kovida
Samarishan Vipra Mahagunastata
Samarishan Vipra Mahagunastata
Sutuvacha
Sutuvacha
Tathaparikshit Dvijavaya Sikshaya
Tathaparikshit Dvijavaya Sikshaya
Mahi Maha Bhagavata Shashasaha
Mahi Maha Bhagavata Shashasaha
Yathahi Sutyam Abhijata Kovida
Yathahi Sutyam Abhijata Kovida
Samarishan Vipra Mahagunastata
Samarishan Vipra Mahagunastata
Sutuvacha
Sutuvacha
Tathaparikshit Dvijavaya Sikshaya
Tathaparikshit Dvijavaya Sikshaya
Mahi Maha Bhagavata Shashasaha
Mahi Maha Bhagavata Shashasaha
Yathahi Sutyam Abhijata Kovida
Yathahi Sutyam Abhijata Kovida
Samadishan Vipra Mahagunastatha
Samadishan Vipra Mahagunastatha
Sutuvacha
Sutuvacha
Sutta Goswami said
Sutta Goswami said
Tata
Tata
Parikshit
Parikshit
Maharaj Parikshit
Maharaj Parikshit
Dvijavaya
Dvijavaya
The great twice-born Brahmanas
The great twice-born Brahmanas
Shikshaya
Shikshaya
By their instructions
By their instructions
Mahim
Mahim
The earth Mahabhagavata
Mahabhagavata
The great devotee
The great devotee
Shashasa
Shashasa
Rule
Rule
Ha
Ha
In the past
Yatha,
yatha, as they told it.
As they told it.
He, certainly. Sutyam,
sutyam,
at the time of his birth.
At the time of his birth.
Abhijata kovida,
abhijata kovida.
Expert astrologers at the time of birth.
Expert astrologers at the time of birth.
Samadishan,
samadishan,
gave their opinions.
Gave their opinions.
Vipra,
vipra,
O Brahmana.
O Brahmana.
Mahatguna,
mahatguna,
great qualities.
Great qualities.
Chata,
chata,
true to that.
True to that.
Sutta Goswami said. O learned Brahmanas, Maharaj Pritchett then began to rule over the world as a great devotee of the Lord, under the instructions of the best of the twice-born Brahmanas. He ruled by those great qualities which were foretold by expert astrologers at the time of his birth. Purport. At the time of Maharaj Pritchett's birth, the expert astrologer Brahmanas foretold some of his qualities. Maharaj Pritchett developed all those qualities, being a great devotee of the Lord. The real qualification is to become a devotee of the Lord. And gradually all the good qualities worthy of possession develop. Maharaj Pritchett was a Mahabhagavata, or first-class devotee, who was not only well-versed in the science of devotion, but also able to convert others to become devotees by his transcendental instructions. Maharaj Pritchett was, therefore, a devotee of the first order, and thus he used to consult great sages and learned brahmanas, who could advise him by the shastras how to execute the state administration. Such great kings were more responsible than modern elected executive heads, because they obliged the great authorities by following their instructions left in vague literatures. There was no need for impractical fools to enact daily a new legislative bill and conveniently alter it again and again to serve some purpose. The rules and regulations were already set forth by great sages like Manu, Yajnavalkya, Pradasha, and other liberated sages, and the enactments were all suitable for all ages and all places. Therefore, the rules and regulations were standard and without flaw or defect. Kings like Maharaj Pritchett had their council of advisors, and all the members of that council were either great sages or brahmanas of the first order. They did not accept any salary, nor had they any necessity for such salaries. The state would get the best advice without expenditure. They were themselves samadarshi, equal to everyone, man and animal. They would not advise the king to give protection to man and instruct him to kill the poor animals. Such council members were not fools or representatives to compose a fool's paradise. They were all self-realized souls, and they knew perfectly well how all living beings in the state would be happy, both in this life and in the next. They were not concerned with the hedonistic philosophy of eat, drink, be merry, and enjoy. They were philosophers in the real sense, and they knew well what is the mission of human life. Under all these obligations, the advisory council of the king would give correct directions, and the king, or executive head, being himself a qualified devotee of the Lord, would scrutinizingly follow them for the welfare of the state. The state in the days of Maharaj Yudhisthira, or Maharaj Pritchett, was a welfare state in the real sense of the term, because no one was unhappy in that state, be he man or animal. Maharaj Pritchett was an ideal king for a welfare state of the world. Om again, for telling the second engine, This chapter is entitled, How Pritchett Received the Age of Kali. That makes me wonder, how are we receiving the age of Kali? It's a very serious proposition. Just like when winter is coming, you know that you need some warmer clothes and you're going to need a strong body to get through all the temperature changes. You can take so many kinds of tonic, like people used to take apple cider vinegar, is that what it's called? So many things you take in order to build your strength so you don't get affected by the winter. Kali Yuga is the season. And an intelligent person should know how to protect himself or herself. How are you receiving the age of Kali? Are you aware that it exists? Are you aware of its ramifications? Just like winter, you know winter means cold wind, cold rain. But what do you know about the age of Kali? Are you really aware of how it's tearing down everything? How it's thrusting degradation in your face at every moment? Are you aware of that? Do you take the necessary precautions to vaccinate yourself, to immunize yourself? Or are you just living in la-la land? Absorbed in your own lusts and aspirations and desires for self-fulfillment. Just like in wintertime, no matter what you think, it's going to be cold, and that will have an effect on you. Similarly, in terms of the age of Kali, you may have all your plans and desires, but the age of Kali is going on. Now what to do? How are you going to receive the age of Kali? The worst thing you can do, of course, is just jump right in and participate. That's the worst thing. The intelligent person, seeing the havoc around, wants to save himself or herself. Now, how are you going to save yourself from the age of Kali? How are you going to avoid being dragged down so that you forget the goal of your human form of life and simply work like an ass for money, just to satisfy your senses? You saw how Wednesday night, someone was objecting that, well, humans are different because they can think, or they can vote, they can have economic and political systems. So I point out, what's the use of all that if the end result of that thinking and voting and systemization is the same thing the animals get without all that trouble? Once again, back to the zoo meditation. The animals get all that without going through all that trouble. So yes, human beings are more intelligent, but if they use that intelligence just to go through complications to get the same things the animals get simply, this is a great tragedy. And we have to hear this again and again so it finally penetrates into our skulls. You can see contamination in yourself when you notice this tendency in you to want to cavort in the devilish delights of the age of Kali. That means major problems. We're having a very difficult time cleaning people up these days. Because, first of all, they don't understand how much they've been blighted. How much they've been destroyed, even from a young age. In order to win the battle, you have to at least know you're fighting an enemy. Therefore, how are you receiving the Age of Kali? Are you aware of what the Age of Kali does? Are you aware of what material influence does? Prichit Maharaj, as described here in the Shastra, is giving the real welfare state. That's a popular term these days, and Prabhupada is pointing out in the purport that those who are running the so-called welfare states have no idea of the welfare of the people. They have no idea how to make people happy. I'm sure this is what you can notice. In spite of all these complicated social, political, economic arrangements, the people are unhappy. Prabhupada would always point out that although in the villages of India, people may have only one cloth, right? The most two pieces of cloth. You can't conceive of that. And although they live in thatched huts, they're happy. Whereas, despite all our gadgets and fashions and conveniences, we're not happy. You couldn't conceive of how you'd be happy just with one or two pieces of cloth that you wash out every day in a well and live in a thatched hut with an earth floor. You couldn't conceive of that. The point is, happiness does not depend on elaborate material arrangements. Prichit Maharaj understood that. Therefore, he ruled a world empire in which the real methods of becoming happy were cultivated. How do you know how to do that? Actually, he knew himself, because he's a great devotee of the Lord. But he also knew that the system is, he's acting as a kshatriya, a Vedic administrator, therefore he takes advice from the brahmanas, the advisors. And the brahmanas, they advise the government without charge. Their thing is they just want to give knowledge. And because they don't take payment, they can't be bought off. These days, as you can see, no one knows anything, but they want to pretend they know something and charge for it. No one has knowledge, but you want to pretend you have knowledge and charge for it. No one can conceive of people advising the government who don't want money. How can you not want money? That means you have to be accustomed to living very simply. But if you can live very simply, it's very easy to acquire knowledge. Because you have so much time and freedom from anxiety, you can devote to accumulating knowledge. So there needs to be a class of person in society who simply has the freedom of time and freedom from anxiety to cultivate knowledge so they can distribute that knowledge. The Brahmanas love wisdom. and they impart wisdom. That's it. They live off of charity, no salary. And if they get more than they need for a minimal life, they give it away. Those are two of the six main activities of a Brahmana. To give charity and receive charity. How can a Brahmana give charity? Because he often receives more than he can need. More than he can use. A Brahmana is concerned. I don't want to have my life so complicated that I don't have time to contemplate knowledge and distribute it. A Brahmana values freedom of consciousness, to be uncluttered. A Brahmana values uncluttered consciousness because I have to have time to reflect on the Shastra and be able to give advice. Pritchett Maharaj, he knew what to do, but at the same time, he knew the Vedic system. So he took advice from the Brahmanas. People are afraid of kings. Does anyone know the name of somebody in British history who said, there's no word I despise as much as the word king? Have you heard that thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I someone find out who said that. That epitomizes modern Western attitude. No word we despise as much as king. People think king means absolute power without check. But that's not the Vedic system. The king was held in check by the Brahmanas. So much so that in the case of Maharaj Vena, he got so out of line the Brahmanas killed him by mantras. Rare thing, but still. The Brahmanas had that potency. So the king was not just running around doing what he liked. This is what people always think. Oh, a king, how horrible. Absolute monarch, does whatever he wants. Automatically that means problems. What is that expression? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's what people think. And democracy, well, you know, that'll protect you. The whole point is not whether there's democracy or monarchy. The whole point is, does somebody know what they're doing? That's the point. Does anybody have any idea what's going on, whether it's a king or the voting public? Does anyone have a clue? That's what we're trying to alert people to. If you want, you can call it any kind of system you want. Democracy, monarchy, thisism, thatism, communism, capitalism. But does anyone know what they're doing? This is our challenge. If you have a democracy, that means the voters have to know what to do so they can elect someone who knows what to do. If the voters don't know what to do, then they won't elect any qualified person. If you have a monarchy, at least one person, the king, should know what he's doing. Therefore, by shifting things from monarchy to democracy, you haven't solved the problem. The king didn't know what to do, didn't know how to guide the kingdom so people would be happy, didn't have any knowledge. So he said, okay, we'll get rid of the kings and we'll give the power to the people. But that just shifted the problem, shifted the burden to the other shoulder. You're carrying the burden on one shoulder, it's weary, you shift it to the other. Why not get rid of the burden altogether? How do you get rid of the burden? By having knowledge, by knowing what to do. So now you just spread the problem everywhere. Instead of a problem of the king who's ignorant, now you have the problem of the voters being ignorant. This is democracy. Democracy can only work if everyone is enlightened. In a monarchy, there is an advantage. If you can just get the one person and get him, the king, to know what he's doing, then everything will be taken care of. Often, government leaders, they would give that excuse to Prabhupada in Australia. They were telling him, you know, we appreciate what you're saying, but there's nothing we can do. We've just got to carry out the desires of the people. That is true. Certainly, even in a democracy, a government leader can do something to make it easier for the people to be Krishna conscious. But it's true. He's held in check by the people. Therefore, in these democratic countries, our solution is we have to educate the people. Then the government will change. Otherwise, you might even get to the heart of one politician. Just like, what's his name? Favorable. David Longy. Okay, he's favorable, but how long is he in office? He goes out in a few years and someone else comes in. But if you can try to get the people, and that's hard work, but that's the only solution to democracy. Because the people, they elect the leaders. Certainly, even in democracy, if you can influence a leader, he can do some good for the temporary years he's in office. He can do a lot of good. But ultimately, the people have to recognize what is their real benefit. Krishna takes part in politics. Nothing is devoid of connection to Krishna consciousness. That's what makes it so fascinating. Krishna consciousness connects with everything because everything belongs to Krishna. Politics is related to Krishna. Economics is related to Krishna. Everything. Why not politics? So if you can understand why Krishna comes to this world and makes politics, then you won't take another body upon giving up the present body. That's the real politics you should be interested in. Why does Krishna make politics? Why did he cause the battle of Kurukshetra? Krishna caused the battle of Kurukshetra because he wanted everyone to be happy. This may be hard for us to understand. How could such a huge battle be for everyone's happiness? Easy! Krishna wanted Duryodhana and company out, and he wanted Yudhisthira and the Pandavas in, for the benefit of the people. From the material point of view, you know, Duryodhana and company, they were good guys, administratively, from the material point of view. But they had one big problem. They were anti-Krishna. But don't think they weren't materially qualified. They were. But they had a problem with Krishna. So Krishna said, okay, I'm getting rid of you. Because there's no way that people can be happy as long as you guys are in power, but you got a problem with me. And all living enemies are my parts and parcels. So in Vedic culture, the king is known as Naradeva, God in human form, in that the king is supposed to execute the orders of God. Most people don't like that. They say, oh, that's a theocracy. It's like Iran. You know, the Muslim fundamentalists. No, there's no way that can be a beneficial society. But instead of just knocking it for the sake of it, theocracy, society under God, why not try to understand what is God first before you knock it? If there can be some study of what is God, if there can be some understanding of what is God, then you might agree. Yes, we should have society under God. But first find out what is God before you knock it. But people have this knee-jerk reaction, oh, theocracy, society under God. That'll be there'll be no freedom. They always make a big deal about how in Iran the women have to cover their heads. How primitive, how barbaric. This is not real freedom. This is not real happiness. They can't wear jeans. They have to cover their heads.
That's what people think of.
Really strict Muslim laws. Oh, we don't want that. We don't want to surrender to strict religious laws. We want to surrender to consumerism. Oh, that's very, very nice. Is it freedom to walk down the street and be assaulted by hot dog smells and lusty scenes everywhere, things pulling at your senses at every step? Is that freedom? Is that happiness? Do you ever feel like that, walking down the street? This is not happiness. Having my senses assaulted this way. And people are working hard for all this. They're working hard to make themselves miserable. You walk down the street and the storm is full of this, and the storm is full of that, and the sounds and sights and smells. Especially as summer gets closer, people will start wearing less and less clothes. Men and women are cavorting everywhere together. That's freedom. That's oppression. You're under the control of all that. But, you know, when you're a materialist in the mode of passion, that urban scene exhilarates you. I remember in my non-devotional days walking around New York City, just feel the action everywhere. All your senses are stimulated. Mm-hmm. Yes, this is it. This is what it's all about. I told you, Al. I hear comments of New Zealanders and Australians who go to New York, and they all say, like, wow, what a rush I get when I step out into the street. Phew, it's like action everywhere. It can't be described. It shows you how twisted the age of Kali is, that people relish becoming under the control of their senses. They relish surrendering to these devilish things. But you talk about religious law, they flip out. What do you think we are? Orthodox Jews or Muslim fanatics or fundamentalist Christians? No, the essential principle today is that everybody does what they like, which means everyone does what their senses say. And in this way, they're so easily manipulated. We are trying to save people from being manipulated. And they think we're trying to take away their freedom. We're trying to give freedom. The irregular principles, they're actually, as Krishna says in the second chapter of the Gita, they're the regular principles of freedom. You can't have any understanding of freedom unless you can control your senses. So the regular principles mean you are free. You are free from the four pillars of Kali Yuga. At least in your attempt to be Krishna conscious, you have to agree to break the four pillars of Kali Yuga. That you have to do. Basically, you've got to take a sledgehammer and just knock them down. At least you've got to do that much. Maybe your life won't be dedicated to spreading the message of Mahaprabhu. We'd like that everybody would do that, sacrifice to distribute Krishna consciousness to others. Maybe you won't do that, but at least smash those pillars of sinful activity. Smash those four pillars of Kali Yuga. Otherwise, there's no question of freedom. There's no question of spiritual life. So people knock a society that's under the law of God. But they don't knock a society that's under the control of Ford or Fletcher Jones. Oh, that's all right. I mean, they know what people want. People want jobs. They want money. They want economic opportunity. You know? So, yes, you can live in a society under the control of Ford or Fletcher Challenge or Toyota or whatever. But live in a society under the control of Dharma? There's no profit in that. Before you get paranoid and freak out when we present that society should be under God, why don't you try to understand what is God? Isn't that the intelligent thing to do? You don't know what is God. Okay, you say, we've heard the Muslims, we've heard the Jews, you know, Mosaic law, and what's the Islamic law called?
Quran?
No, there's a special term for it. So anyway, we've heard all that, laws of the Hebrews, laws of the Muslims, but, you know, sounds very fanatical. Why not try to understand the best knowledge about God? And then you won't feel so uneasy about following the laws of God. Okay, we'll give you some credit that you feel uneasy about Dharma, about following the laws of God, because you don't know anything about God. And the religious systems you've encountered, they don't give you very much information by God. So we'll give you some credit. Therefore, we can understand you rebelling in this way. Nevertheless, it is a fact that even by following the less developed systems of laws of God, still you have benefits, but you get nothing for this animal life that's going on these days. I think I told you how, when Prabhupada was in Tehran, Iran, it's around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he was hearing all these sounds of lambs bleeding all over the city. He asked, what's going on? And he said, this is the time, according to the Quran, where you can kill lambs and make it so their blood runs towards the direction of Mecca, and then you can, you know, then you can eat. So, you know, Prabhupada, you might think, oh, how horrible. Abominable. No, he said, well, at least they're following some kind of religious principles. At least they're acknowledging that there is Shastra and Shastra injunctions. It's like in the Vedas, there are regulations for meat eaters. It's not that the Vedas are sanctioning meat eating, but they're recognizing there's a class of persons in the mode of ignorance who have to eat flesh. Therefore, rules and regulations are provided. How to do it? The point is to eventually get the persons attached to rules and regulations, not eating meat. So these things in Vedic culture are licensed, they're meted out. M-E-T-E-D, not M-E-A-T-E-D. They're dispensed in measured proportions. People don't like that these days. All these Kali-Yugas things are meted out in these Vedic injunctions meant for less than 1,000 people. Things are regulated. Alcohol is regulated. Meat is regulated. Sex is regulated. These things are meted out. They're dispensed. And there's a way to partake of them so you don't destroy yourself. You'll feel comfortable about following the laws of God if you will understand God. Then you won't dismiss it all as old theocracy, fanaticism. Why don't you try to understand Krishna, and then you'll feel more comfortable about following what Krishna says. But just to dismiss things without ever trying to understand, religious fanatics, society under God, laws of God, no way. Why not try to understand God first? So you all have that opportunity, how to understand Krishna. See, that's the thing. Don't feel strange that we have to present to people that society should be under Krishna. Oh, they're not going to like that. If they'll understand what is Krishna, then they'll feel, sure, why not? But they don't understand what is Krishna. And in the back of their mind is, oh, we've heard about Mosaic law and, Islamic law, They don't know the reasons why those laws are there. Women covering their head and not wearing jeans. They don't know the reason. It's fanaticism. The whole purpose behind even their primitive religious laws has been forgotten. For no one to do. That's why in the Padma Purana it is stated all the rules and regulations of the Vedas are maidservants of one purpose, that you always remember Krishna and never forget him. Rules and regulations are meant for that point. That's why in Nectar of Instruction, one way for fall down is not attachment to rules and regulations, and another way is over-attachment to rules and regulations so that you forget the point of the rules and regulations. You're noting in this verse that Prichit Maharaj, his qualities were foretold by great astrologers, expert astrologers. As you all know, it's not easy to find an expert astrologer. It's practically impossible this time and age of Kali. Of course, marriage compatibility, that's not a very involved thing. It's not a very subtle thing. Marriage compatibility, that can easily be done these days. But predicting someone's future, predicting events, that is very difficult. very hard to find astrologers, practically impossible to find astrologers who can do that. They may make some lucky stab every once in a while. But in Pritchi Maharaj's time, that was actually possible. Astrologers could. They're expert enough to say this person will go through such things in his life. They predicted at the time of Pritchi Maharaj's birth that he'd be cursed by a Brahmana boy. Now, they cannot predict response because that's up to you, but they can predict what the weather will be. They predicted Pritchi Maharaj has so many good qualities, extraordinary qualities. When the child was born, the expert astrologers would be called in. Every person in Vedic society had access to topmost wisdom. Why is that? Because the Brahmanas would wander from home to home, giving free medical advice, the Brahmanas they knew Ayurveda, giving free astrological advice, and giving free spiritual advice. So any man, any person, regardless of their economic standing, had access, ready access to wisdom coming to the door. The Brahmana would simply ask for a little bit of food. That's all. This is the system. It's not that you had to, in order to get knowledge, you had to pay thousands of dollars to go to the polytech and get ripped off. Thousands of dollars to go to the university. No. Right to your door it would come. The Brahmanas knew medical knowledge, they knew astrological knowledge. Any poor man could find out what his future would be. And of course, the Brahmanas knew spiritual knowledge. Now no one knows anything. And you even have to pay for this so-called knowledge that people are getting. It'd be bad enough if it was for free, but you got to pay for it. At the time of birth of the child, the Brahmanas are called in. The Jati ceremony, the birth ceremony, and they make a prediction. This is part of the Garbhadan Samskara system. They're a system of samskaras, or Vedic ceremonies for purification. And Garbhadan Samskara is one of those 10. They're 10. The first one is when the child is conceived. How is a child conceived in Vedic culture? It's a big secret. You know, the mother and father, you know. They have a child by accident, the contraceptives aren't working, or they're drunk one night or something. Now, what is the Vedic process? Everybody knows. Everybody knows. The father and mother announce, we want to bring into the world a child. And so they consult the Brahmanas. And the Brahmanas tell them, this is a favorable time. This will be an auspicious moment. And so they actually perform a Vedic ritual called Garbhadan Samskara. And everybody knows it. Everyone's happy. Oh, you have to bring into the world a child. Not some kind of secret, illicit act, you know, steal away. That's glorified in Western culture. Let's steal away. Slink off into the shadows. No, Vedic culture means everybody knows. The Brahmanas are consulted. Yes, this will be an auspicious moment. So they have a ritual. The Brahmanas pick the day and have a big ritual that day. And everybody knows. This day, this man and woman, they're going to conceive a child. Vedic culture is that deliberative, that planned. This is real Planned Parenthood. So, that's the first samskara. And then the child is born, and you have the second one, the name-giving ceremony, in which the Brahmanas look at the astrological future of the child. Now, the Brahmanas, they can calculate astrology not only when the child is born, but when the child is conceived. Why is that? Because everybody knows when the child is conceived. So the Brahmanas can take all that knowledge into account. They're expert, and the society is also expert, too. Everybody is doing things in very orderly ways. And because the Brahmanas have high qualities, their consciousness, their intelligence is very sharp. Of course, you know the rare example of the astrologer who came to Lord Chaitanya's door. You can read about this in Adi Leela, Lord Chaitanya's youthful pastimes. Astrologer Brahmana came to the door, and Lord Chaitanya was a youth, so he said, "Oh, can you please tell me my future?" So the Brahmana sat down and began to calculate, based on Lord Chaitanya's birth, what his horoscope would be. But he did more than astrology. Also, he meditated through his brahminical powers. He could meditate and see in that way. So he was astonished what he saw, what he calculated. He saw a unlimitedly effulgent body, the source of the spiritual world. So he was quite confused. And then he looked at Lord Chaitanya and he realized, this person is the same as this unlimitedly effulgent body I saw with the spiritual worlds coming out, illuminating the spiritual worlds, right? This is the same person. And Lord Chaitanya asked him, noting that he was a bit, confused. Well, what's my horoscope? Come on, just tell me what the future is. And the Brahmana replied, I can see that in your past life, you were the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And in this life, you are also. And Lord Chaitanya looked at him, I don't know about that. All I know was that in my past life, I was a cowherd boy, and because I took care of the cows, now I've taken birth in the Brahmin family. So the astrologer was that advanced that he could actually, through astrological calculation and meditation, see that he was dealing with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord Chaitanya, of course, would not admit he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead because he's taking the mood of Krishna's devotee because he wants to understand the mood of Srimati Radharani, so he doesn't want to be disturbed in that mission. Lord Chaitanya is Krishna coming in the mood of Srimati Radharani. So therefore, he never says he's God. He's always a devotee. And he's also teaching what great benefits you'll get just by taking care of your cows. How you can develop religious principles just by taking care of cows. But these days, they don't take care of cows, they kill them. So, any questions?
Where
are the Brahmanas? In the age of Kali, Kalo Sudra Sambhava. Everyone's born Sudra. There's practically none.
I was just wondering, we used to be about king. If the democracy was pulled, if we change from democracy to like a kingdom, would that make a difference in the age of Kali?
We change from?
If we went back to a monarchy?
Simply going back to a monarchy won't make a difference, no. Whether you have monarchy or democracy, someone has to be Krishna conscious. That makes a difference. Hmm. They still have monarchy somewhere in this world. It's a, Africa was a small state. Hmm. Maybe Bhutan.
Netherlands.
Huh? But that's not a functioning monarchy, is it? No way. That's not a functioning monarchy either. The king still has some power there. But everywhere in democracy is the way to go. So it doesn't matter what ism, in one sense, but connected to Krishna consciousness. Nevertheless, the best system is monarchy in Krishna consciousness. Because not everybody can govern, and not everybody knows about government. But that's the ruse that's being perpetuated on the people now. You all know what to do, just vote. You all know what kind of nation should go on. They tell you that, but it's actually cheating. The common man just casts his vote, but those appeal about, well, you know, while you're just, you know, just scratching your head and voting, and you can vote all you like, but the things are going their own way. And that's why people are getting frustrated. They know it's all a show. They see crime going up. They see their, you know, society becoming unruly. They see their taxes going up. That's the only thing that's happening these days. Crime and taxes are going up. Therefore, Prabhupada points out in the Bhagavatam, and you can see it with your own eyes, once people get frustrated with democracy, they'll go to a dictatorship. They'll just want any strong guy who will stop the crime and stop the chaos. That's what they'll go for. Do what you like. They leave themselves wide open for a dictator. And we've seen that even in this century. Any strong man, he'll save the day. People just get tired of chaos. Just like in Russia now. Mm-hmm. People, you know, they've got terrorists blowing up apartment buildings in Moscow, the capital city. 100 people dying at a time. You know, they say it's the Muslims blowing up apartment buildings. So the people are, you know, in a panic. You can imagine, you know, here in Wellington, you know, you wake up in the morning and you hear across the street, you know, a whole apartment building was blown up and 100 people died in the middle of the night. You know, who's blowing up apartment buildings? Why? What's the government doing about it? So it puts people in a real panic-stricken condition. And in that mood, they'll say, do anything. You know, put, you know, lay down any kind of draconian laws and strict controls. Just stop this terror. And their politically shrewd people are waiting for that moment. Yes, yes, we'll save you. Just give us all the power. It happens again and again and again. Same old thing. You can imagine if there was terror in New Zealand, part of buildings blown up, ferry being blown up. People get so freaked out. And then somebody says, I'll take care of it all. I guarantee I'll stop all this. Yes, yes, okay, do it, do it, do whatever is necessary. That's what people are like when they're panic-stricken, or when they're hungry, or when they're terrified. And then the politicians, you know, they invent some scapegoat. All the problems in this country are due to this group. And people like that. Yes, yes, we do it all the time. They even just tried that recently in Australia. One lady politician became very popular all of a sudden, saying all the problems in Australia due to too many foreigners here. So all the other political parties, they were, of course, playing holier than thou. Oh, you are racist. Oh, you're, you know, how undemocratic. So many immigrants have built up Australia. And you're criticizing them. But actually, in their hearts, you know, they couldn't care, but they just figured, well, you know, because the Orientals were protesting. We're not sending any more money for buying things in Australia unless you stop this lady. That's what it's all about, money. So the other politicians, they protested. Why? Because they really thought that she was saying something outrageous? No. They protested because she was becoming more popular than them. How can you say such things? Australia is an open society. No, they're just thinking, we've got so many votes. We've got to stop you one way or another. And then the Asians, they're going to cut off their capital. We don't want that. We won't be getting any more bribes from Taiwan for, you know, giving you land development permits and things like that. It's all going on these days. Same old thing. And the people are just suffering more. Isn't it? So interesting how people suffer even when they have so-called prosperity. Look at the suicides in New Zealand. No one is hungry here. Everyone gets the minimum. But still people are committing suicide. So many times, the Sankirtan devotees, you meet people and say, yeah, I know 6 people who committed suicide. Why? That shows you people do not know what the purpose of government is, what the purpose of society is. And they'll never be able to link all this havoc to the fact that they can't control their senses and they know nothing about God.
This is the great ignorance today. No one understands what is God. They don't know what is Krishna. And they expect things to go on all right in spite of that. So you all become knowledgeable in the science of God and teach them. Any of you here can do that. It just takes some sacrifice. Equip yourself with Krishna Tattva, the science of Krishna, and teach others. You just read these books and repeat them, and you'll be the most, you'll come across as the wisest person. And by your distributing this book, these books, you're distributing knowledge. You're taking the place of the brahmanas. That's what you're doing. That was Prabhupada's plan. There's no brahmanas, so we'll distribute the Vedic knowledge in the form of books. And actually, in that case, in that way, you're more than the brahmana. Vaishnava is more than the brahmana.
You said before that if we teach who Krishna is, then more likely to accept his Lord. Society out there, all the financial thing, and commerce, and the fashions, and the cars, and everything, I mean, that's reality to people. So trying to tell people that, you know, that God has revealed himself as, like, as Krishna, as a cowherd boy from Darwin, you know, straight by gopis and saying, straight, although that is the ultimate reality. It's so, it contrasts so much with society that they don't even give them a chance. They just swipe it completely.
You have to know how to do that. That's why you want to know how to preach. You have to learn from others. You don't just say, hey, by the way, God, you know, plays a flute surrounded by gopis. You explain how God is the supreme enjoyer. Explain how you have the enjoying propensity because you're part of Krishna. But your enjoying propensity is problematic. Mm-hmm. In Krishna, it's unlimitedly perfect. Because you are part of Krishna, you display, in a minute degree, the same behavior as Krishna. But Krishna does it unlimitedly, with no problem. Then they can start to understand. You want to taste relationships. Krishna is always with relationship. Krishna is never alone. Even in the atom, Krishna is not there. Wherever super soul is there, the soul is there. Wherever the soul is there, the super soul is there. Krishna is never alone. It's no fun being alone. So Krishna is never alone. He's always surrounded by his entourage. Even in the atom. So you have to know how to present. You have to do two things simultaneously. And you'll learn to do that here at the law. You have to present Krishna while simultaneously negating their misconceptions. You just don't want to negate. But in order to present the real thing, you've got to pull out some weeds so the real plant can grow. So both things are done side by side. That is Prabhupada's process. That was his expertise. That's why he would say things like, the more you kick on Darwin's face, the more you worship Radha and Krishna. In other words, this bogus science is getting in the way of people understanding the real science. You think life comes from matter. You don't understand the first thing about God. God is the supreme life. And from God, all other life comes. Now, what is it that the supreme life does? In an office, in a factory, making life? No, the supreme life dances with the most beautiful women. Everything you'd like to do would fail miserably. Supreme Life even incarnates as the woman, the most beautiful woman, just for the fun of it. Mohini Murti. You've read about that in the 8th canon? Yeah, Krishna's woman incarnation. Whatever Krishna does, it's unlimited and the best. He can be the best cheater. He can be the best woman too. You should read the 8th canon.
He blew Lord Shiva's mind completely. Lord Shiva was, you know, he said, I've heard about this Mohini Murthy incarnation that bewildered the demons. And I'd like to see it. Now, Lord Shiva, he's the master of austerity. His consort is Durga. She's the material world. But Lord Shiva is so renounced that, you know, he never comes under her control. Although his consort is Durga, Lord Shiva just, you know, lives very austerely. So Lord Shiva said, yes, I would like to see this Mohini Murthy form. And the Lord said very gravely, are you sure? You know what you're getting into? In so many ways, the Lord said like that, just smiling very gravely. Do you understand what you're asking for? So then to fulfill his desires, Lord Shiva's desires, Krishna appeared as Mohini Murthy. Lord Shiva was right there with his wife. Oh, he looked up and he saw in the distance this inconceivably beautiful woman wearing just a thin, you know, thin attire, thin meaning filmy. Krishna knows how to do it. Beautiful, stunner, wearing just filmy attire, you know, and bouncing a ball. Yeah, just bouncing a ball, playing with the ball, and sometimes, you know, the wind would blow and, you know, blow the flimsy, filmy attire a little bit this way, that way, and when she was watching. Bouncing the ball and playing with the ball her lingerie is just flipping this way, that way, just bouncing. So Lord Shiva just flips. Ultimately, he just loses it. His wife is right there. He just forgets about that and just goes running after Mohini Murthy. Leaves his wife right there, running after her. And then she's Krishna, so she knows how to, you know, make a real adventure. Lord Shiva's chasing her, and she allows him to just get his hands on her, and then she slips out of his grasp. And he's just going mad, you know. Well, <had her. laughs> lost her again, he's running and chasing her. Actually, what happened before he began to chase her, what happened that really blew his mind, he was right there at the side of his wife and watching her, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you know, the female incarnation bouncing the ball, and the garment slipping this way and that way. He's watching and he's losing it. And then, you know, Krishna knows how to do it. A breeze comes and blows her garment off completely. And that's the Lord designed to do. He just put him off. Got him. How can you compete with Krishna? So he chased Mohini Murthy all around the earth. Krishna was arranging that so that everybody would learn a lesson. He chased Mohini Murthy past all the hermitages of the sages, and Krishna was showing, the dog, you better watch it. So then Lord Shiva's passionate fit ended. And then he came to his senses. Prabhupada writes in the purport, that's the way it is, you know. Before the passion is resolved, you know, your head is filled with so many visions. But then, simply afterwards, you realize, well, what was that all about? Well, how did I get in this situation? Then Krishna told Lord Shiva, don't feel too bad. After all, you know, you weren't bewildered by Maya, you were bewildered by my internal potency. Whatever Krishna does, unlimitedly, it's the best and the most pleasurable.
Anything else?
Is there a good example of Krishna, someone becoming lasting and greedy for Krishna?
Yes! Lord Shiva, in his defense, coming to his defense, Lord Shiva was not bewildered by the Lucy energy. He was bewildered directly by Krishna's internal potency.
Mm.
He was chasing Krishna. Mm. That's why Krishna told him, don't feel so bad. He was a bit humiliated, too. Because in the beginning he was really keen. I've heard about that form that's bewildered the demons. I'd like to see it. And that's why Krishna looked at him and smiled very gravely. Are you sure you know what you're getting into? First, get them to understand that the Supreme Absolute Truth is full of opulence, and then you can discuss what those opulences are. You've got to get them to see their hypocrisy. They want opulence, but they deny opulence in the Supreme Absolute Truth. They want relationship, but they deny relationship in the Supreme Absolute Truth. All right, so I guess we'll have a program tonight.
Here.
Are you teaching yoga at the lot?
Yeah.
Up to what time?
5:37.
Mm. It's the high number 3. Mm.
And 3.
Mm. Mm.
Okay.
All right, so we'll have class here tonight.